This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look at the top stories in the coming week from our Daybreak anchors all around the world. Straight ahead on the program, U.S.-China trade talks set to resume in Washington, plus minutes from the September Fed meeting. I'm Bob Moon in New York.
I'm Amy Morris. How will lawmakers get the business of government done during an impeachment investigation?
And I'm Caroline Hepke in London, where we look ahead to Ireland's 2020 budget. Finance Minister Pascal Donoghue under pressure to prepare for Brexit fallout on the Irish economy.
I'm Jessica Summers in New York, where we get an inside look into the collapse of Venezuela's oil industry, the theft that goes on, and the lack of security after Bloomberg reporters traveled through the nation's key oil field that accounts for nearly all of its remaining production.
And in Asia, the protests in Hong Kong are heating up. What might cool it down? I'm Brian Curtis in Hong Kong with that story coming up.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak on Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 99.1 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Good day to you. I'm Bob Moon. We begin today's program with the trade story. As the Trump administration gets ready to host Chinese Vice Premier Liu He and other senior officials for negotiations in Washington. Let's get the latest now from Michael McKee, Bloomberg International Economics and Policy Correspondent. Mike, thanks for joining us. So what's in store, and give us an update on where these talks stand at the moment?
Well, it's an interesting question, what's in store. How much progress can they really make, given that the president is not backing off on trying to make the Chinese uncomfortable? And the Chinese, in their week that just passed to celebrating the 70th anniversary, don't seem to be in any mood to give ground to the U.S., at least under pressure. So can they really do anything? That's the question. The talks have been stalled for quite some time over what they're going to be talking about. They had put together a document that, by some accounts, was 80-90% agreed to in terms of the overall negotiations. And then the administration, the U.S. administration, accuses the Chinese of walking away from that. And then the U.S. is demanding they go back to that document. The Chinese say, no, they're going to do something else. So we're not even sure what they're going to be talking about when they sit down, which makes it harder to know what they can accomplish.
You know, as long as these talks have been stalled, we still keep hearing the president saying we're in good shape. Who's right here?
Well, I would go with the talks are stalled and we don't know argument, because trade negotiations are notoriously complex and difficult. And the president tends to come out and say things like that when he's in other political trouble. He also doesn't want the public to turn on him because the economy is going south because of trade problems. And we have seen that, particularly in the manufacturing figures that we've had recently. So I would not assume things are terrible, but I wouldn't assume that we're any necessarily closer to getting an agreement, given how hard all of this is to do.
Well, the president said on Thursday that he thought that the reason that the economy looks a little soft is because of all the problems that the Democrats are throwing up in the way of things at the moment. Is that what it looks like?
No, that's not what it looks like. I mean, the thing that got everybody on Wall Street all upset was the ISM manufacturing report last week, which showed contraction, much worse contraction in manufacturing than had been anticipated. And if you looked at the release from the ISM people, didn't mention the dollar, didn't mention the Fed, only mentioned trade wars as the reason for it. So I don't think we're doing anything but trying to avoid further damage from trade wars. But if this is what is going to be the result of the president's trade policies, and he's got an election next year, then that gives him motivation to try to come to some sort of deal.
Now, is there anything that we have heard from the administration that they might have some sort of plan to get these talks off the dime, or is it all just wishful thinking?
Well, I don't know that it's wishful thinking. It's a hard slog to go through these things. We have to divide it into two. One is the bilateral trade deficit, which is what President Trump has been so concerned about for so many years. Bring down that bilateral trade deficit because China is taking money from us, which they aren't, but that's a whole separate argument. But if the Chinese want to buy more American stuff, that is relatively easy to arrange. The real question is what they do about the way they run their economy. They have passed legislation in China to crack down some on intellectual piracy, and so that may help. They have talked about ending forced technology transfer, and in some cases will allow now a full 100% ownership of Chinese companies by foreigners. And so there's some ground there that could be the basis for compromise. But one of the biggest issues is that China subsidizes what they call the technologies of the future. And the United States wants them to stop doing that. But China says this has been our economic model. It's brought us way out of poverty. We've gone from a small developing economy to the second largest economy in the world in the last 15 years, and we don't want to stop.
Let me give you a scenario, and you feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. They don't reach an agreement, and the economy does begin to slow down. It's as simple as just reversing the tariffs, correct?
You would have to reverse the tariffs and convince business that they were going to stay reversed. And part of the problem is the president's been very inconsistent about this. And so nobody really believes him when he says he might do something like that. Nobody's going to immediately jump in and start investing in the hope that the president's going to keep his word.
Our thanks to Michael McKee, Bloomberg International Economics and Policy Correspondent. Let's turn to monetary policy now after the Federal Reserve lowered its main interest rate for a second time this year. We'll get a look behind the curtain in the coming week with release of the minutes from the September meeting. Let's get more on the central bank's next move with Ira Jersey, Chief U.S. Interest Rate Strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence. Ira, welcome. What are you expecting out of these minutes, first of all?
So I think the minutes are going to have to explain why some of the members were more hawkish, especially given we've seen some pretty weak data points over since the meeting. The information that we've received hasn't been particularly good, so the minutes have to reflect these two members who didn't want to cut interest rates in September and what would maybe make them change their mind. So why were they specifically not willing to cut? Because you know those folks have not been marginalized yet, and So if we wind up getting some additional data or if the Fed doesn't want to cut, they're going to wind up being very loud voices in the intermeeting period.
Well, what's your educated guess on what was going on?
Yeah, I think people just looked at a lot of some of the incoming data and said, we've already cut a little bit. We wanted these to be insurance cuts. We have to see, because monetary policy works at long and variable legs, did this work? But since the meeting, data's gotten a little bit weaker and certainly more susceptible, particularly some of the manufacturing data that we've seen. So I think that, you know, even though we're going to get this information, it's not going to be quite as important, because the more recent data that we've had suggests that the Fed is probably going to cut at the October meeting. And in fact, the market's been pricing for that.
So these are supposedly insurance cuts. At what point do they say, all right, we've insured ourselves enough?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So the market had thought that they would cut one or two more times and then be done. But because the data over the past week has been relatively weak, if you look at Thursday's ISM non-manufacturing number, that was well below economists' forecasts. So data like that is going to make them nervous. So I think, you know, two more cuts are probably going to continue to be priced into the market. And, you know, then it really becomes as data dependent. If the data stabilizes and it doesn't look like we're going in recession, then the Fed might pause. But you're still looking at least one and probably two more cuts before that happens.
Well, given the data as it looks now, what are the chances that they cut deeper?
Yeah, if these trends continue, I think that the market will start to price more and more cuts into 2020. And because they're cutting more into 2020, then the next question that people are going to start to ask, and I've actually already been asked this a few times over the past couple of weeks, is when does the Federal Reserve start full-blown quantitative easing? So when do they restart their large-scale asset purchases like they did during the financial crisis? And the answer to that is probably not until they cut to zero, but there's only about six or seven more cuts that they have to do in order to get to that zero bound.
But for now, October and December look likely for cuts.
Yeah, I think, you know, October's certainly 100% priced in. I thought that maybe they would skip October and start what Jay Powell, what Chairman Jay Powell has called organic balance sheet growth in October. But given the weakness in the data, I do now expect October to be a cut, and then December to probably be a cut as well.
Our thanks to Ira Jersey, Chief U.S. Interest Rate Strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence. And let's head to the commodities space now for the week ahead. And for that, we bring in Bloomberg's Jessica Summers. Good day to you, Jessica.
Bob, 5 decades ago, Venezuela pumped 3.7 million barrels of oil a day. Now it's only producing a little over 700,000 barrels a day. Bloomberg reporters drove more than 400 miles on a 3-day tour of Venezuela's Orinoco oil field, which produces more than 90% of what's left of the nation's output. They also spoke with employees of state oil giant PDVSA. Latin America oil markets reporter Lucia Casay was on that tour, and she joins me now from Houston to talk about the trip and give us a firsthand look into the current state of Venezuela's oil industry. Great to have you, Lucia.
Hi, Jessica. Thanks for having me.
So to start with here, what was it like traveling through the Orinoco field a few weeks ago? What did you see there?
Well, what I saw was a ghost town, to be honest with you. I've seen abandoned million-dollar equipment, rigs, pumps, empty tanks. It was an eerie experience, to be honest with you, because from the distance, the oil fields, they look like any other oil field. But when you get closer, you get to see the equipment is rusty, the pipes connect to nothing, and power lines are hanging from poles. And, you know, some of the equipment, they have signs warning you about high temperature. But when you get closer, it is all quiet and the tanks are cold and ring hollow. So my colleague Fabiola Zerpa, our correspondent in Caracas, and I, we saw a crude oil treatment facility that caught fire a few months ago. And it's still sitting there, a mess of twisted and charred metal. The oil that was inside the tanks is sitting in an open air pool, and the smell is nauseating.
Wow. I also want to talk about the theft that goes on there. I know it was typical for oil to be stolen at night to avoid the security cameras, but now it's happening in broad daylight. Why is there such a lack of security now?
Well, the thieves are growing bolder because the security cameras, you know, they used to protect the oil fields were stolen. People steal the cameras to sell them for food. And, you know, the minimum salary in Venezuela now is about $2 per month. And that's why, you know, it's a tough situation for the Venezuelan oil company, PDVSA, because they need the equipment to produce oil and pay bills. But if they fix, you know, the equipment, if they put a new camera there, thieves may steal it again. And these oil fields, they sit miles and miles away from the nearest towns. They are unmanned operations, so they are an easy target. And thieves will strip cables for the copper that is inside. They will open power generators for the diesel fuel. Because of that, it's not easy to repair or replace the equipment. And also, you know, many employees, they have stories to tell you about kidnappings and robberies while they are doing work. So it's not an easy job.
And it does seem like PDVSA is in a very tough situation. So what will it take to see a recovery in Venezuelan oil production? And how much would it cost? How can the field become safer?
So Fabiola and I, we spoke with several analysts and experts to get an idea of what is necessary. So number one thing would be the exit of the president of Venezuela, Nicolás Maduro, because Maduro and his predecessor, Hugo Chavez, are largely responsible for the current situation.
Of course, it's going to be very interesting to continue following the situation in Venezuela. Lucia, thanks so much for joining me. It was so great to have you talk about your trip. This is one of the topics we're watching in commodities for the week ahead. In New York, I'm Jessica Summers. Bob?
Thank you, Jessica. Let's head to our Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington to see what items in politics and government are set to top the agenda in the coming week. For that, we bring in Bloomberg's Amy Morris. Amy.
Thank you, Bob. All eyes are on Capitol Hill now, even though Congress is on its 2-week break, but congressional investigators continue gathering evidence in their impeachment probe. Let's look ahead to the week in Washington with Bloomberg Washington reporter Kathleen Hunter. Kathleen, it's a pleasure. Thank you for taking the time with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
got a couple of closed door testimonies that we've heard from this past week. What did we learn from those, and where could that take this investigation moving forward?
Well, I think chief among them, when late last week, there were three House committees that took testimony from Kurt Volker, who is the now former envoy to the Ukraine from the U.S. And he, as part of that testimony that they took, they spent a long time behind closed doors with him. There was a bunch of exchanges and text messages and other exchanges that were released as part of a pretty massive document dump. And those were really kind of putting some meat on the bones of what we learned from both the transcript of Trump's July 25th call with the Ukrainian president and also the whistleblower complaint, which we've seen. And what I mean by that is that we got to see some of the exchanges between U.S. officials, between Rudy Giuliani, and also between Ukrainian officials vis-a-vis this effort that Trump allegedly was trying to spearhead to get the Ukrainian government to investigate Joe Biden. And so now we have actual text messages and actual email exchanges that we can read. That certainly do seem to indicate that Trump and his associates were trying to orchestrate this investigation of the Bidens.
And Kathleen, we have not really heard a lot from the Republicans. They've either been brushing this off, or they've defended the president, full throat defense, or they are silent on this. So is there any indication we're going to hear more from them in the coming week?
Well, I would not necessarily expect their strategy to change, with one pretty major caveat, which is that I think all along I've thought that, you know, once we start seeing the polling on this, if there is an indication of a major shift in how Republican or independent voters view this issue and or how they view Trump, i.e. if Trump's support among his base begins to show signs of slipping, I think then we're likely to see potentially more Republicans coming out and going beyond what we've heard so far, which is really primarily just a couple of Republicans voicing misgivings about the president's behavior, i.e. indicating that perhaps it wasn't the best approach, but really stopping short of condemning him, or certainly stopping short of saying that they would, particularly on the part of senators, support removing him from office. And so I think that that's really the chief indicator to watch, is where the polls are. And we did have some interesting indications from Nancy Pelosi over the last week or so, in that she's indicated that the polling that she's looking at, which would be internal polling, has indicated that there are shifts. However, I think most of the public polls haven't shown dramatic shifts yet, but I would say definitely stay tuned and watch that closely.
And not just lawmakers. Let's look at cabinet members. Secretary of State Pompeo standing by the president. He was also on that questionable phone call. What may be coming up for him in the coming week?
Yeah, so he had a very eventful week. He was traveling in Europe, and also the subject of, some State Department officials were the subject of some of these House inquiries, and we would expect to see that going forward. And so I would imagine at some point people on Capitol Hill are going to want to hear directly, the House Democrats are going to want to hear directly from Mike Pompeo himself, and hear more about, you know, this call that he was on, and potentially more about why he indicated initially that he, you know, seemed to indicate initially about a week ago that he actually didn't have a lot of knowledge of this issue in this phone call. And then it came out this past week that he, in fact, was on the call. And so I think that that has in some ways, you know, called into question how forthright he's being on all this. And I think that that means that he's likely a target of these congressional inquiries as they try to get more information, both because of what he knows and also about how he's handled the matter so far.
And we're getting word that Energy Secretary Rick Perry, who has already said that he would cooperate with this probe and answer any questions because he has been to Ukraine, he has met with these people, he's also planning to step down by the end of this year.
Certainly. And that does certainly open the door for Rick Perry to be more cooperative, perhaps, than, you know, Mike Pompeo or other administration officials with whatever questions House Democrats have for him, given that he's not planning to for very much longer be a part of the administration. And so I think that makes him more of a free agent. And so if I was a Democrat in the House, I'd probably want to find out, you know, everything that Rick Perry knows right away.
Kathleen, thank you so much. Bloomberg Washington reporter Kathleen Hunter, and that is what is happening in the nation's capital. I'm Amy Morris. Catch more of our political coverage weekdays on Bloomberg Balance of Power from noon to 2 Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio. Bob.
Amy Morris reporting from our Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington. Thank you, Amy. Coming up, the Irish government gets set to present its 2020 budget. But first, let's head to Hong Kong, where clashes between protesters and police continue to escalate as Chief Executive Carrie Lam struggles to control the unrest. Let's get the latest now from Bloomberg Daybreak Asia anchors Brian Curtis and Doug Christner.
Bob, protests here in Hong Kong look set to escalate now after a protester was shot in the chest at close range. This action has enraged protesters across Hong Kong, and they're vowing to step up their actions. And given that, Doug and I thought we'd take a close look at what actually needs to happen to move the path forward. Joining us is Karen Lee, Bloomberg's China government editor. So, Karen, we're in the escalation mode right now. What might have to happen for us to see de-escalation?
Well, what we've been looking at in past weeks as both sides seem to entrench further is what can be done by either one of them to try and lessen some of this tension here. And at this point, Carrie Lam is probably going to need to make some kind of concession or overture more than she's done so far to protesters. And increasing police's tactics against them, shooting a protester in the chest, isn't a step in that direction. It's only going to make things worse, especially when you remember that one of protesters' key demands is an independent inquiry into police's tactics against them in previous weeks of protest. And they say that police have been overly aggressive. They've used hundreds of rounds of tear gas, rubber bullets, now live ammunition. And that's something that's probably going to fuel their anger, bring more people out onto the street this weekend and next weekend. And that kind of turnout, whether it's sustaining momentum and fueling momentum, is something we're going to be looking at very closely.
So many of these protesters, as I understand, have adopted the motto, five demands, not one less. What are the demands that they're seeking?
Yeah, I mean, they've said that they won't back down until Carrie Lam meets those five demands. People walking through the streets, especially over the last couple of weeks, holding their hands up to use their five fingers to symbolize those demands and saying that they won't go home until they're met. That includes the full withdrawal of the extradition bill, which she's essentially taken off the table, the commission of inquiry into the alleged police brutality, retracting the classification of protesters as rioters, which is something that's been very controversial here. And the protesters say, you know, we're not rioters. Stop calling us that. Amnesty for people who've been arrested and detained at protests over the past few months. Police have made hundreds of arrests and they want to see all of that wiped off. And universal suffrage, really a call for more freedoms as these protests morph from what was effectively opposition to one extradition bill into a greater call for more democracy in Hong Kong and a pushback against Beijing's increasing grip here.
It would seem like one of the most important and easiest to do would be to declare this independent inquiry, particularly if you set up an inquiry that's headed by a judge. You actually get two birds with one stone. Everyone respects the judiciary in Hong Kong. It is seen as independent, and it's one of the pillars of strength in Hong Kong. And separately, you would get an independent look at the actions of police and the actions of protesters. But it seems that the government is saying, oh, it'll just take too long if we do that. Is that the main defense that they have for not calling it?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that you could argue at this point would go the furthest toward kind of calming down some of this anger from protesters. And Carrie Lam recently held her first public dialogue. She had a town hall style forum, and people who asked questions referenced the independent inquiry or police tactics. So this is clearly something that's very high on people's minds. And a lot of people here think that if she did that, if there was some amnesty for people who'd been arrested, and we've seen some pretty violent images of people being wrestled to the ground and detained in that kind of forceful way, that could go the furthest at this point. And it would, in a way, be the easiest thing for her to do.
And the ultimate aim is supposed to be universal suffrage. The protesters would like to see at least the reform process to start. You could argue that we haven't had any progress whatsoever in the past 5 to 8 years.
Yeah, I think for a lot of protesters, the demands, they have bigger demands that they want. But I think that in the shorter term, they probably have a fairly realistic view of what's possible, especially with the current setup between Beijing and Hong Kong. So I think for a lot of people, really focusing on these amnesty for those arrested and the independent inquiry and the ability to go out and protest. I mean, the police have been banning protests more than they had toward the beginning of the summer. At the beginning of the summer, you saw these mass marches being organized and a million people coming out onto the street, and they marched peacefully. And toward the end, there would be a small group that would break off. And now you're seeing these marches get banned, and that's only fueling that anger.
Karen, thank you so much for being with us. Bloomberg's China government editor, Karen Lee, joining us here. I'm Doug Krisner, along with Brian Curtis in Hong Kong. You can catch us every weekday here for Bloomberg Daybreak Asia, beginning at 6 a.m. in Hong Kong, 6 p.m. on Wall Street. Bob.
Thanks, Doug and Brian. Let's head to Europe now, where the Irish government of Leo Varadkar will present its 2020 budget in the coming week amid a backdrop of Brexit and a global economic slowdown. For more, let's head to London and bring in Bloomberg Daybreak Europe anchors Caroline Hepker and Roger Hearing.
Bob, Ireland roared in 2018 with growth of over 8%. That has cooled in 2019, whilst unemployment has edged up. The fallout from Britain's departure from the EU could hit growth, job creation and Ireland's key agricultural economy.
Well, for more, we're joined by Bloomberg's Dublin Bureau Chief, Dara Doyle. Dara, what is the Finance Minister, Pascal Donoghue, actually likely to announce in this coming budget? And could there be any surprises?
So the reality is there's probably very little new announced in the budget next week, and I'll tell you why. Essentially, what the government has decided to do is to approach the budget on the basis that there will be a no-deal Brexit. That's not because they think there's actually going to be a no-deal Brexit necessarily, but because it's a prudent way to do business, just in case it does happen. So what does that actually mean? Well, you know, if there was an orderly Brexit, they would be forecasting the economy to grow by over 3%. Because they're going to assume a no-deal Brexit, that means the economy, the assumption would be the economy grows about less than 1%. So that leaves a little room for tax cuts, that leaves a little room for big spending pledges. Instead, what they'll do is they will earmark any spare cash for Brexit contingency measures to help, you know, industries like farmers and fishermen. If there is, in fact, a no-deal Brexit.
Okay, not a huge amount new, but then there are more than just the threats of Brexit and a no-deal Brexit to the Irish economy, aren't there? We've also got, of course, the issue around the global economic slowdown. Is that as big a factor for the finance minister for this budget as Brexit is? How do you weigh the risks?
Well, I mean, you're right that Ireland is an incredibly open economy. It's an incredibly trading economy. The U.S. is an important market. So, for example, the tariffs that are being introduced on some goods will hit the Irish economy and exporters. But I think almost the total focus right now is on the possibility of a no-deal Brexit. And there's a couple of key reasons for that. I mean, what will happen in a no-deal Brexit is that sterling will plunge probably 5-10%. That will make many Irish exporters uncompetitive when they try to sell into the UK market. So it'll take a huge hit there. The second thing that will happen almost overnight is that tariffs will likely be placed on Irish goods going into mainland the UK. Now, look, Ireland's reliance on the UK as an export market has lessened massively over the last sort of 20, 25, 30 years. But it's still a huge market for, you know, the likes of farmers, for some manufacturers and this kind of thing. So you're looking at that sort of double whammy of sterling falling plus tariffs on Irish goods going to mainland UK. You know, you're looking at a huge hit for the export sector. So by far and away, the biggest focus is still Brexit, while in the background, Trump tariffs still loom, you know, loom, but much less so.
But Dara, I suppose the nature of Brexit is almost unknowable, at least in some of the ways it affects the UK, let alone Ireland. So I guess despite the idea of prudence, there's actually not a vast amount that Donoghue can actually do.
I mean, I think you make a fair point to an extent, but what we do know is that sterling will almost certainly take a huge hit if there is a no-deal Brexit. And what we do know is that Irish exporters will face, you know, tariffs on goods going into the UK. These are just things that automatically kick in a no-deal Brexit situation. So against that backdrop, you've got to look at the sectors which are most vulnerable, the farmers, the fishermen, for example. So there is a certain amount you can do in providing funds to shelter them, but I think you do make a kind of a valid point that actually these funds can only be marginal. They can only give them a certain amount of relief. They will still face a huge hit in a no-deal Brexit.
But even running into Brexit, things have been cooling in Ireland, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a slight slowdown, but you should put that in context. You've still got an economy here that, although it's slowing a little bit, is still the fastest growing within the Eurozone, I think, or certainly one of the fastest growing. And in fact, the problems that we're facing at the moment are not so much about a slowing economy, it's a fact about trying to, you know, of dealing with how quickly the economy has grown. So, for example, one of the huge problems the government is facing is, you know, we have this massive influx of tech firms like Twitter, Facebook, Google, what's not, there isn't a huge amount of accommodation here. Rents are surging fast. People can't grow houses. A second problem that the economy is facing is a massive labor shortage. You know, companies can't find qualified people to fill the jobs. The wages are rising quite quickly. So, in fact, a lot of people would argue that a slight cooling of the economy is not a bad thing because we're at the point where we could be overheating in the short term. Now, there's a difference between a mild cooling of the economy versus, a huge hit that you might face from a no-deal Brexit. I don't think anybody's got a massive problem with the economy slowing a little bit, but I think, in the unknowable situation of how a no-deal Brexit will unfold, that's a sort of a different situation. But the feeling is that we're reasonably well sort of positioned to deal with a no-deal Brexit, but, I mean, obviously nobody can tell exactly how bad it's going to be.
And our thanks there to Bloomberg's Dublin Bureau Chief Dara Doyle. I'm Roger Hearing.
And I'm Caroline Hepke in London. You can catch us every weekday morning here for Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, beginning at 6 a.m. in London, 1 a.m. on Wall Street. Bob.
Thanks, Roger and Caroline. That does it for this edition of Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend. Join us again Monday at 5 a.m. Wall Street time for the latest on markets overseas and the news you need to start your day. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.